Come with us quietly, Billy. Don't argue or make a scene. Because if you say anything more about the Last Knock or podcasting, we're going to be forced to take you to a mental hospital. You wouldn't want that now, would you?
No.
Your response, Billy, is supposed to be stunned silence.
Oh.
And you walk out without saying a word. Jeez.
Sorry, I forgot.
In any case, I am Johnny Numb Saperstein.
I don't like that tennis root, Doctor.
just drink the drink, Rosemary. Just drink the drink.
I want more chocolate mouse.
She ate the chocolate mouse, dummy. Just shut up.
In any case, and who are you? Who are you tonight?
I'm Guy Woodhouse, you bastard. Oh, man. I'm Billy Crash.
No, you're a Charlie Nobody, Billy.
I'm missing a glove. Anybody see my glove?
Poor Hutch. That's all.
Yeah, poor Hutch got screwed royally, man.
Oh, man. And the other guy, the actor who got turned blind. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
In any case, yeah.
If you don't know what we're talking about now, then you don't know horror.
As soon as we're done love quoting this film, we're doing another show in honor of Women in Horror Month.
Yeah.
And you could call it a macabre milestone, you could call it whatever, but hey, 2018 marks the year Rosemary's Baby turns 50, my God.
Wow. Wow, looking good. Kid's looking good with the hooves and the horns. He looks great.
Billy, I think if we slap some horns on you, you could pass for Rosemary's Baby.
I am Rosemary's Baby.
Son of Rosemary.
Mm-hmm. I got goat eyes, man. What did you do to its eyes? It's his father's eyes. Hail Satan! Sorry, man. Do this shit all night. It's like Star Wars.
Oh, it's so quotable, Billy. There's no undertaste at all to our conversation.
Oh my God!
But in any case, Rosemary's Baby is the 1968 film adaptation of the Ira Levin novel,
which he loved the adaptation, by the way.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I gotta say, Billy, we were talking about another film adaptation off mic before the show. It is seriously one of the closest film adaptations of a book that I've ever seen.
Yeah, Ira Levin, he was really happy with it, and he said every time he sees a Hollywood adaptation of a movie, he cringes, and not with this time. He was very happy. And a lot of people credit that to Roman Polanski, that this was his first adaptation and he didn't want to screw anything up. So he really stuck to the actual novel.
And it was also his first English language production, which could have gone, mm-hmm. you know, in a drastically different direction.
Yeah, his first American shoot, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In New York.
Yeah.
So essentially, the high level outline for anybody who hasn't seen this movie, and I'd be surprised if anybody among our listeners has not seen this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, a young couple, Rosemary and Guy Woodhouse, played by the great Mia Farrow and John Cassavetes, respectively. Oh, yeah. They choose to move into this extremely moody, atmospheric, almost Transylvanian apartment house. in New York City, and you know they're quickly welcomed by their next door neighbors, the Castevets, Roman and Minnie, played by Sydney Blackmer, and the inimitable Ruth Gordon.
Oh yeah.
And you know they're feeling all warm and cozy, you know, and you know, but it turns out, you know, there's weird stuff being heard on the other side of the matrimonial wall at night from the neighbor's apartment. And what could that be? It sounds like chanting. It sounds like something slightly amiss. And Rosemary eventually gets pregnant and finds herself sort of tied into this whirlwind conspiracy where she is kind of always one step behind what her I don't know what her captors, tormentors, nosy neighbors, pretty much, yeah, what they want for her, which hey, spoiler alert, they want her to have the son of Satan, basically. I know, jeez.
Dun 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 dun.
You know what happened to the good old days when your neighbors in the apartment next door were just yelling really loudly at sporting events like the ones downstairs from me do. So
can you imagine banging on the wall and it's like the son of Satan shows up at your door? What are you banging on the wall for? Oh shit, I'm sorry, man. Like don't kill me, man. Like what would you just say?
You're just like Bill Hicks there, Bill, doing Satan voice.
I'll take it. Bill Hicks killed, man. He was awesome.
Needless to say, there's no Bill Hicks style Satans in Rosemary's Baby.
No, there isn't. There's a lot of, man, rumors abound, man. Like, with the party scene, you know. And I have to look. And I know it's a rumor at that. Can't be substantiated, but like in the party scene is Roman Polanski's wife Sharon Tate, you know, before the murders, and it's like I don't think so, you know. But
are you talking about the last scene, Bill?
No, I think it was the party that she was having, you know, with her girlfriends and stuff.
Yeah,
and like you know, Anton LaVey had been a consultant on a film, which isn't true. You know, he's the founder of the Church of Satan.
Yeah,
it was like no, he wasn't. But you know, I don't know why these things start because the movie's got enough really cool things about it, and you don't need any embellishment.
Yeah, and maybe we can start off just like as we sometimes do, Billy. What was your first exposure to the film, and what were your initial impressions of it? And have your impressions changed at all over time of the film?
My impressions have been solidified over time, and that's a cool thing. Yeah. God, I saw it a gazillion years ago. Just watched it one night. It was like one of those horror movies you're supposed to see. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, it rocked my world. I just fell in love with it. To me, it's a 5-star horror. I just was completely enraptured by the feeling, the way the whole story unfolded. The not necessarily... naive innocence of Mia Farrow's character of Rosemary, but you know, here was a happy young woman who wants to have a child, who wants to have a wonderful life with her husband, who wishes him success. She wants to be a mom, and she's just a wonderful, wonderful person, and all this shit comes down on her. You know, it's like, and that's why she's targeted, because she's so damn wonderful. She's empathetic. She's sympathetic. She's a sweetheart. She cares about other people. She's tolerant, patient. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And here she is. All of her dreams, her goal to have a child is totally upended by Satan. And it's like, this is so wrong. You know, to me, it's one of the saddest horror movies ever made in the end. And it just really just struck a chord. And I loved the strength that she showed later on in the film. And I loved the transition of that. And it just, and the cinematography by, we haven't mentioned his name yet, William A. Fracker.
Oh, yeah.
Holy hell. Amazing. And just absolutely stunning. And he really brought the story to life. And of course, you know, Roman Polanski's, you know, directing is just spot on. And John Cassavetes in his role. As portraying a bad actor was fantastic. And, you know, Minnie Castavet, Ruth Gordon, she won the Oscar for that part.
Did she, or was she only nominated?
I think she might have, she got the Oscar for, what was it, and Maude.
Harold and Maude,
I believe she got the Oscar for that. But Sidney Blackmer, you know, who's Roman Castavet, you know, he had a lot of trouble saying that, you know, God is dead, hail Satan stuff, because it really affected him. And but you know, everybody brought it, you know, and Roman Polanski made sure everybody brought it, and he made sure that William Castle was, you know, sort of like corralled to a degree.
Yeah, you know, Bill, it's interesting. I have the Criterion version of the film, and there's it's like a 46 minute featurette with it's just Polanski, Robert Evans, who is the producer,
yeah,
and Mia Farrow, and they do talk about how William Castle almost seemed like was he trying to like sabotage the film a little bit, kind of before the production started?
I don't know about that, but I mean, you know, anyone who knows William Castle, the guy who did The Tingler and all of the cheesy B horror movies,
The Gimmick King,
yeah, absolutely. It's like, oh man, he could have really ruined this, and one, he didn't, and number two, he even appeared in it, you know. When she's in a telephone booth, the guy trying to get in is William Castle, and which was great. And I think Evans, I think he was the producer who was like making sure that, you know, don't undermine, let Roman Polanski do what he's doing, leave him alone. And I think he was the one who helped make sure that the production went in a solid, dramatic horror fashion and didn't become some cheese fest.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, that was definitely accomplished. There is some like really dark humor in the film and some incidental humor that I really like about it, but for the most part it is more just you're kind of getting inside of Rosemary's headspace, but she doesn't have all the pieces, she doesn't have all the Scrabble tiles, as it were, to play a full game of Scrabble. So she's in this constant process of like, she starts to think a certain way about something and then she discovers it to be true, or, you know, something like that. But, you know, it's like the Satanists are already like two or three steps ahead of where she's at.
Right.
But she keeps fighting against that. She keeps pressing against that tide in a way. And something, Bill, that I had a problem with, I guess, when I first saw the movie, or the first couple times I saw it. I mean, I thought it was brilliantly shot and it was a cool story. Great performances, pretty much all that. But I had this weird reaction to Rosemary as a character, thinking,
really?
Oh, it's like, I was actually thinking, like, why are you so, granted, the first time I saw it was like in my second go around at college, but I was kind of like, oh, come on, why aren't you picking up on this stuff? Why aren't you ahead of the game here? But that's not her fault. And the last time I watched it was, which was just a couple of days ago, I was like, you know what? She starts to pick up on stuff more like intuitively and kind of maternal instinct wise.
Right.
Like she knows stuff is, you know, off from pretty much the moment she starts in on the chocolate mouse. You know, it's like, oh, it's tasty. But then it's like, oh, it has a chalky undertaste. And and John Cassavetes, he is such an asshole in this movie.
He was so perfect for that role. And, he nailed it.
Yeah, apparently there was some friction on the set because he was, you know, a filmmaker himself, and he was more used to playing stuff kind of like fast and loose and more improvisational, whereas Polanski was more like stick to the page.
Yeah, and I think that has to do with him wanting to make sure that it was true to the book again as well. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. But I thought it was interesting how every time Rosemary would raise an objection, Guy would be like, okay, you object to this. But then he would like start listing stuff to guilt her into feeling a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same thing a psychopath does to somebody.
He was essentially playing on her emotions and trying to wear her down to the point where she just is like, okay, I agree with you. Even if I don't agree with you, I'm just going to say it so we can stop the argument, kind of thing.
Yeah, and it plants the seeds of self-doubt that just permeate. So it's really hard to get out of that until you reach a point where you can remove yourself from it and like turn your head on backwards and see like, oh, that son of a bitch, you know?
Yeah, and... yeah, I did like the dynamic of their relationship because, you know, it's...
I wonder how they met, man. You know what I mean?
you know, and it's fabulous, Bill. And I mean, go back to the very beginning of the film where it's like just, you're walking along with them through this great gothic building, and Alicia Cook Jr. is the Renfield
Oh.
character showing him the property and everything.
Well stated. Yeah.
It really is like Dracula's castle in Midtown New York,
It's
basically.
the Dakota.
And I just love how the camera moves along, and Guy and not yeah, Guy and Rosemary are so happy and carefree, and their clothing is colored kind of brightly or lightly. And then it's like, oh, what's with this weird armoire that's blocking this linen closet, what's yeah, so it's I just love that. It did remind me of like something out of like gothic horror. And what do you think of that, Bill? Like, what do you think of the film's relationship to that particular subgenre?
Well, it's really cool that you brought that up because of all the elements that I was looking at within the film, I never made that comparison before, and I definitely should have. I guess I was thinking more of the individualized themes, of but and also how this relates to it was almost like Roman Polanski did like a trilogy of sorts, with the with Repulsion and with the apartment, what was that
The
one? The
tenant.
Tenant, yeah, I'm sorry, The Tenant and this, and looking at the solitary elements of living in an apartment and being, like maybe sheltered away or not having necessarily decent neighbors or whatever. But what you said is excellent in regard to, I'm thinking now in a way, it's like almost like a Fall of the House of Usher story in many ways now. And so I could see that. Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely. Not just because of the looks, but because of the feel, the atmosphere. And again, that goes to, Fraker and his cinematography, also the editor, the way it was colored. And it's so interesting because, now that I think about it with the gothic element, when they first move into that empty, giant, freaking apartment that nobody could afford today in any way, shape, or form.
These apartments are the size of small houses, basically.
Yeah, definitely. And, it was so vast. And what was it? The weird plants in the one room?
Yes, from the previous tenant, yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, whoa, that was just so, it was unsettling. It was almost like there was mysteries within, not just within the walls, but like behind every door, there was something new and different. And pretty much there was in this story. And that was one of the things that I guess I liked the most. Now that I think about it in a gothic sense was like, I'm thinking of, you have hidden rooms and everything else, but in a sense, they did just have that. Between apartments and who could hear you and yeah, that was cool. It's yeah, it's creepier now than I even now that I think of it.
Something you were talking about the cinematography and the production design, Bill. Something I like, and it goes back to like you notice in the beginning how like the close-ups of Rosemary and Guy. Rosemary especially seems like a very tall, luminous. She kind of towers in a way, the way she's filmed, and like as the film progresses, you get a lot of these like sort of I don't know if you would call them long shots or medium shots, where it's like across the room, like after the one part after the party scene with her young friends, where she's just sitting at the table and she's got her hands between her knees, and she just looks so reduced by
Yeah,
comparison.
exactly. Yeah, oh yeah, she's totally knocked down. She's being It's funny because like there was an element of confidence, here, God, we have a new apartment. My husband's going to do well with his acting. We're going to have a child. Everything's going to be wonderful. And then as she's undermined, she falls. I mean, at one point she looks like a heroin junkie in the freaking movie.
Oh my God, yeah. Where she's waiting outside the Time Life
Yeah.
building.
Oh my God. And you're like, get her to a hospital. It looks like the worst case of the flu I've ever seen, and it's like, what? Oh my God, poor Rosemary. And And yeah, she is. You know, she's worn down. She's hunkering down. She's falling. She's being diminished constantly by Guy and the neighbors. Oh, and the doctor, Dr. Saperstein.
God, yeah.
Oh man, and good old Dr. Hill, Charles Grodin, man. But
he said Charlie Nobody.
I know. Oh, when he said when John Cassavetes said that line, I fell off the couch. I was like, yeah. That, like he was like. It was like, but it was so cool, you know. It's just like, oh man, but man, that was just I forgot even what I was talking about because you made me laugh. But
no, that's okay, Bill. Well, what do you think about the you know, would you say that Rosemary's Baby is a feminist film, or would you say it skews more towards the, I mean, the patriarchy has an immense presence in this movie, but you know, after having watched it a bunch of times, I feel like, you know, you are on Rosemary's side.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, my favorite scene in the whole movie, my favorite scene of all, is when the bassinet's rocking and she takes the knife and she stops it with the knife. And I'm like, yeah, you know, and she marches in there and she does her thing. And, but, you know, a feminist film, I mean, we see her become aware. We see her become, her regain her confidence in a different way. Mm-hmm. Whatever elements of innocence she had are definitely lost now. The vulnerabilities are gone. But still, it was like, you know, because what I hate is, to me, there's like a mix because Roman Castevet at the end, you know, when Rosemary's trying to get to her baby, you know, he's like, you know, he's the king of the witches, you know, all of them witches. And he's mm-hmm. like, no, let the, you know, let the baby be with its mother. And it was almost like he was allowing her, which I, on the one hand, I didn't like, but I'm thinking, well, what's next? Like, is she going to be subversive? Cause she changed the mind of the son of Satan, you know, could mm-hmm. she, cause think about what she went through. And in fact, the actor, oh my gosh, his name is Clay, who played the devil.
I don't know.
I had it. Clay Tanner. Not Tannis. Clay Tanner.
Just Clay Tanner roots, Billy.
Oh my God. He played the devil, and she said when he did that scene, he was completely naked. And when the scene was over, he shook her hand and said, it was a pleasure working with you. And she said he was a very lovely man. But, you know, that scene's horrible. Here she's thinking she's having a nightmare when mm-hmm. all these people around her, all of the witches and her scumbag husband and, you know, they're all hanging around her, watching her be raped by the devil.
And they're all naked, too.
And they're all naked. And it's just so horrible. And you know, she's upset and she's crying. She's like, what's going on? And they're like, oh no, everything's gonna be fine. And it's like, you know, it's pretty much like, yeah, let Satan rape you. And and I was thinking like how them collectively, it was like all old world thinking type of thing. But you know, she does become empowered at the end, and I think that's the main thing that I'd love about the movie is the whole what comes next, because now she is mm-hmm. not a minion. She's not going to be abused again. She's not going to let this happen to her. She's fought through it. She has her child. Doesn't like the father, but you know, it's like,
yeah,
you know, so I can't even imagine what would happen next in regards to her having time with the child and trying to manipulate or change. It's like, don't be like your dad, you know, like, what do you do?
Well, it's almost like by default, like you said, Bill, she's assimilated now into the coven just by, you know, she makes this discovery, and I don't know if they would have revealed it to her eventually or not if she hadn't discovered it. But mm-hmm. you know, it's like something that I thought was really powerful is that last shot that pushes in slowly on her face as she's looking down at her child as she's rocking the bassinet, and a smile comes to her face. Like there is that twinkle of like maternal, dare I say, unconditional love in the mother's eyes at the end of the film.
Yeah, could it be hope? Could it be self-delusion? Like, oh, I have my baby. And it's like, you know, she suddenly got past the eyes. It's like, is she like kidding herself to try and survive? I mean, I don't know. And I think that's the beauty of it. What do you think, man?
You know, I think that's a good point too, though, Bill, because after all she's been through, and, you know, when she sneaks in through that secret passageway, that's a great, it's a great sequence where she, you know, takes away the panel and she walks into the Castevets, and she's just kind of like lurking, and she sees like the paintings that were taken down when they were over initially, like of a, it's like of a church burning and of the coven. And then when she enters the room, it's wonderful because you just see person by person taking notice to her the more she like creeps into the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she does go, like, she looks at the child and she's like, she's essentially telling Roman to shut up. You're in Dubrovnik or whatever, you know, you're in some foreign country because you're supposedly dying, you know, and, but then, you know, she does, she screams, what have you done to its eyes? And the bombshell is dropped. And I would say that they're, you know, quote unquote, you know, traditional hysteria going on that might play into like a state of delusion, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel by the time we get to that point, I think she's kind of collected herself to a degree, because she sat down, she's watched all the people fawning over each other and, you know, over a job well done, and, you know, she spits in guy's face and all that stuff.
Oh,
and
that
I'm like,
beautiful, man. And he just backs away into the shadows.
You know, Bill, a moment I like, and it's the moment that comes right after the thing I quoted for the opening.
Mm-hmm.
When Dr. Saperstein enters Dr. Hill's office where Rosemary has been waiting, Guy is with him.
Yeah.
And Guy is kind of, he's kind of reduced in that scene. He's like in the middle between Rosemary and Saperstein, and he's almost kind of in shadow. And he kind of bows his head.
Yes.
And is that shame? Is that, you know, what is that bow? And I was thinking, has Guy been made the devil's bitch in his own way?
Because absolutely.
He's made this deal and he's been trying to orchestrate everything in his like cool, slick, actorly way. Is it possible that he's really harboring these like feelings of, okay, well, I made this deal, but I'm going to have to do X, Y, and Z to maintain this sort of thing? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, his egomania won out, and, you know, he fell for what Roman Castevet was selling. And, you know, once he proved it, like, holy crap, they could really do this shit. They really have power, you know, and he just fell for it. But, yeah, the thing, like you said, the devil's bitch, that's definitely it. And because Roman Castevet, at the end of the day, he's the king. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, even when, you know, she, Rosemary spits on, you know, Guy, and he backs away and all, you know, Roman's like, he doesn't even flinch. He's like, fucking whatever. He's a piece of shit. It doesn't matter. He's going to get what he wants. We got what we want. And we're going to protect her because now he's completely done.
Yeah.
You know, he's done with, he might meet a strange fate rather soon. You know what I mean?
He might lose a shoe or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, where's my shoe? Oh, son of a bitch. I'm falling out the window. You know, it's like, you know, he's gone. He's not needed anymore. He's nothing. He's zero. And I think he realizes that too late. And in the meantime, he's ruined lives, many lives, and maybe the whole planet.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that I like, Bill, like there's implication and there's stuff that's like kept off camera. Like Rosemary calls the actor who suddenly went blind after Guy made his deal with the devil.
Yeah.
And it's a genuinely unsettling scene because Rosemary's like, you can tell she feels, you know, she says, oh, me and Guy feel horrible that Guy has essentially profited from your misfortune. But you can tell it's only her who means it, basically.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and then she's like inadvertently gets a bit of information from this guy that, you know, turns into another like bit of revelation for her regarding the fate of Hutch eventually too.
Oh yeah. Poor Hutch, man.
Yeah.
Tannis wrote, which doesn't exist, of course, but
Pregnant women are supposed to gain weight, not lose weight, Rosemary.
But the doctor said, and Guy says, and everybody else says.
I'm so sick of hearing what's best for Dr. Saperstein. What about what's best for me?
Come on, Ro. Come on. And oh, that's one of the things that really bugged me all the time. I mean, you have a woman named Rosemary. She is your wife. You love her. You could call her Rosemary. You could call her Rose. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't. He can't even say her full. He says Ro. Why the fuck? Rose, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful name for a beautiful woman who loves you and all. Call her Rose. Mm-hmm. Ro. He can't even say it all the way because he's such a misogynistic bastard, and he's just not appreciating her for the full woman that she is.
That's a keen fucking observation, Bill. And it goes into everything else that's done, like, in a visual way in the film. Like, reduced to a one-syllable word.
Yeah.
And she's reduced as a woman. She's reduced as an individual and a character. You know, she shrivels down into basically a stick, you know, as she's pregnant with this awfulness inside of her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just so spot on. And, you know, speaking to the word Rosemary, Bill.
Yeah.
You know, there's, of course, the dual meaning of the herb. And, you know, you have that little, the previous tenant who was growing herbs.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of like plant and floral imagery, like in the wallpaper, on floral prints on clothing. I noticed that the bed in the dream sequence that Rosemary finds herself on, initially there's like no coverlet or anything. It's just a plain mattress, and there's a floral print on the mattress.
Right.
That very interestingly, it seamlessly goes over into like a black coverlet and a black pillow later in the hallucination dream or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought that was neat. And I also, it interestingly, there are times when Rosemary's in the bedroom and there's sort of a orangish yellow tint to the wallpaper when the sun is coming through the window.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of a story I read back in college by Charlotte Perkins Gilman.
Oh, called, my God, yes, the yellow wallpaper.
Because isn't that story is essentially about a woman who's going insane, right?
Well,
from what I remember of it.
Yeah, because she's being forced to go insane by the, you know, it's about a woman trapped in a room, you know, with the yellow wallpaper and what she sees within that wallpaper. And it's an amazing feminist tale. And I used to actually teach it in class when I taught Intro to Lit. Because I thought it was a story that students needed to hear. That and, oh my gosh. Ah! Kate Chopin, the Story of an Hour, which I think are two brilliant feminist pieces. And, it's really powerful. And it's like, she's she's... She's forced by men to not do what she wants to do. And, oh, no, you have to do this. You have to do that. You know, and she knows her body and she's trapped in her house. And that beautiful apartment becomes a cage and her own prison. And it just goes on and on. So, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And I think the reason Levin's novel probably played, you know, probably read so well to Polanski is because, I mean, you look at Repulsion, which is essentially, it's a little bit like Rosemary's Baby with the baby removed. Because it's like, well, there's what is real, what is inside the character's head.
Sure.
You're not given those concrete narrative elements that would like solidify these things as the film goes on. It's more like it, even at the end, like we were talking about, it's kind of left. What is she really feeling at the end? We can buy that this whole plot has come off and it is indeed real, but you know, what is left at the end? And I think that ambiguity is a real strength of the film, and I think that's probably one of the reasons it's endured outside of all the other reasons we mentioned in its strengths in aesthetic and performance and just storytelling. So
yeah, and still we have the Roman Empire Castevet, who, regardless of what she wants to do, he's so arrogant, obnoxious, you know, he's going to worm his way into her life and try and, you know, play with her mind and twist her into being a particular thing. So his work's only just begun, because Guy, and it's a great name for him because he's just a guy and he's going to be gone. And yeah. Woodhouse, I'll blow your house down for real. And that's exactly what Castevet's going to do. Because, you know, within two scenes, Guy Woodhouse is dead. You know, it's like he's gone. But I could see Roman Castevet doing that. Honey, you're right. Guy did this to you, but I took care of him. He'll never bother you again. He's gone. You know, and using that as leverage to try and get her to come around to his way of thinking.
You know. Oh, totally. And I think the thing is, Roman is a very charismatic fella. But he's very charming. He's kind of like the old guy who's like, you know, I've traveled around the world and you know, and that's he seduces Guy kind of with his stories and whatever they talk about when the ladies aren't in the room. And you know, I think that's interesting because Sidney Blackmer does such a good job of being so ingratiating a presence. He's not pushy. No. He's not, you know, he's not angry or mean. He's not twirling a mustache or anything like that.
He doesn't need to, because he knows he's better than the rest of them. He knows he's smarter. He's older. He's wiser and everything else. And it's, you know, he's obnoxious in that regard. But he's an egomaniac-like guy, but better at it and more intelligent. Yeah.
Well, he's been on the planet longer too, so.
Mm-hmm.
But I like how initially it's like Minnie is the one who's like totally, she's sort of the messenger, like the invasive messenger. I'll bring Laura Louise over and we'll knit a while and just invade your space for a time. So
she's like a little female Loki or something, you know, from Norse mythology. Just, you know, chewing her food. Oh my gosh. Oh, just like, you know, after you watch it a few times, just watch it whenever she's on the screen, even when they're not, you know, like people aren't talking at her, just find her and watch her. And she's just in friggin' credible, especially with the way she eats. It's like, my God, you make me look like I'm a fine diner lady. She was perfect for that.
Yeah, and you know what, Bill? The first time I saw that movie, I was like, oh, my God, I hate this nasal-voiced woman so much. I cannot stand her. But you know what? In the ensuing years, I've actually watched Harold and Maude, and I was like, you know what? Ruth Gordon was the first manic pixie dream girl in a movie with Harold and Maude. So, yeah. You know, she's definitely grown on me for what her character symbolizes and just her sheer, like, she has no filter, she has no sense of boundaries, and I kind of like that.
Yeah.
And she's depicted as kind of like the quote-unquote normal woman. It's like, oh, well, it's natural to bring your friend over to meet the new, you know, the new young lady in the apartment and just gab a while and, you mm-hmm. know, do some knitting, maybe play some Scrabble or something, Rosemary.
But I think one of the important things is we're missing out. We didn't talk about the first young lady, at least one of the young ladies that they had chosen beforehand. And that was actress Victoria Vetri. And I love the whole little line in there when Rosemary goes, you know, you look like that actress, Victoria Vetri. Oh, yeah, I've heard that before. I don't see the resemblance.
Oh, God, I totally missed that. Okay.
Oh, my God, it's one of my favorite lines in the film, man. It's great, you know. And she was, you know, selected, you know, for breeding, spawning purposes, and it just didn't work out for mm-hmm. whatever reason. And whoops, something happened, you know. Next. And that's the other thing, because up until the point of the child's birth, she was, you know, Rosemary was completely expendable. And we only wonder in time, as that son does grow older and doesn't need breast milk and all this other crap, that she's going to have a little accident of her own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, once the child no longer needs the mother, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bill, something I thought was interesting, and it I don't know why it didn't occur to me sooner, but do you feel like there's sort of a weird battle of the generations going on amid all the battling for the soul of Rosemary's child? You notice how I noticed how, you know, Guy and Rosemary, they're young, they're full of pep, they're optimistic about the future. And, you know, Terry, who you mentioned, and Dr. Hill, who's on the young side as a doctor.
Yeah.
Then on the other side, you have Roman, Minnie, Laura Louise. You got Dr. Mm-hmm. Saperstein, who I was like, he looks like fucking Sigmund Freud. And that was probably intentional.
Yeah. Ralph Bellamy, man. He was always cool no matter what he played, man.
I was like, oh, my God, he's one of those characters you just want to reach through the screen and strangle, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And you want to beat Guy to death.
Yeah, pretty much. You want to beat him with those fake crutches he's practicing on. So.
Oh, man, he was so awful at that. That was.
Yeah.
I'm the worst actor in the world, and I'm going to. Not John Cassavetes, but the part he was playing, you know, it was just like, oh, man.
Yeah, and I thought that was interesting, sort of that generation gap, to the point where, you know, you have those two parties. You mentioned the one, Bill, where Rosemary invites just their friends.
Yes.
You know, and they're all on the young side. And Roman and Minnie are not invited.
Yeah. Her parents, she doesn't even have, like, we don't know anything about her family because she's not attached to them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, too.
You know.
And then you have preceding that party, you have the New Year's Eve party, which is extremely awkward and uncomfortable with.
Yes.
Rosemary sitting on the couch next to Dr. Freud, and while everybody else is partying and it's very awkward, it's the old person party, and they're all wearing stupid hats and they got noisemakers and everything. And I just thought that was an interesting contrast that was in Levin's book and in the film, that adds, it sort of drives an additional wedge between the characters and the dynamics and how, you know, okay, if you're part of a certain generation, you relate to other people from that generation in a certain way. But if you're part of like a preceding generation, you relate to people perhaps in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I love is Levin didn't go there and Roman Polanski didn't go there either in regards to it's the 1960s. You know, the generations are pretty much at war with each other, you know, Vietnam and everything else. And, you know, they weren't like hippie-esque, the young people. And if anybody was a little bit, you know, hippie-esque, they had an element of being refined. They weren't caricatures of like, hey, man, you know, like none of that crap. And it was great. They were all real people and, you know, just separated by age. And that's what I like, too. You know, they didn't go to those ludicrous extremes. Although the Castevets definitely had their own eccentricity. They were eccentric in many ways.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and Bill, another thing I noticed was we've been talking about the set design and the production design. The differences in the two apartments, they are really like almost literally night and day. I was talking about the bright colors of the wallpaper and the walls in the Woodhouse apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, the Castevets, obviously it looks more lived in. You've got tall bookshelves going up to the high ceilings, and you have these very dark, like mahogany walls, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like a fascinating, it's just like, oh, duh. Okay. They're evil because, you know, they've got all this dark, you know, the dark, dark colored furniture, the dark walls.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the Woodhouses are more like, you know, they're young and they're quote unquote good people.
Mm-hmm.
And something else I noticed was I don't think we see, I guess outside of the final scene, the scenes that take place in the Castevet apartment are I think they're all at night.
Mm. Yes, I think you're right.
I mean, I think there's only like one or two scenes in there before you get to the final scene.
Mm-hmm.
But But I know the initial meeting between a Guy and Rosemary and Roman and Minnie is like it's like a dinner gathering.
Right, and I think any time there's like a daylight shot with the cast of vets in it, mostly Minnie, it's her coming over to the Woodhouse apartment
Yeah.
for something to bug them in some way.
And when they discover like Terry after she jumps out the window, it's like that's night. Everybody's coming back from a Broadway play or something like that, including Roman and Minnie, so
Oh, Minnie. Oh, Minnie, you're so fine. Sorry, couldn't help it.
Well, Bill,
Gotcha.
something I was thinking about was and something I hate about Hollywood movies, especially I guess more comedies, is the depiction of the pregnant female
Yeah.
used as a vessel for a quote unquote hysteria or vulgar jokes or whatever. Oh, it's
Right.
like, oh, she's crazy. She's gonna rip her husband's head off because she's got, she's going through mood swings and oh, she's projectile vomiting because she has morning sickness
Yeah.
and it's funny, this 9 month struggle. And what do you think about how Rosemary's Baby depicts like it with do you feel like there's an accuracy despite the fact that it's very much in the horror world to the depiction of Rosemary and her situation?
Well, I've seen so many different women pregnant in so many different ways. I don't think there's any one way. I mean, but that's like the only way I can answer it. I've seen women go through pregnancy and gain a little bit of weight. I've seen women go through it and gain 40 pounds. I've seen, definitely, moods change, taste change. My mom told me, like, you should go like with each one of us. Well, when I was pregnant with your sister, I wanted, cheese and crackers all the time. When I was pregnant with you, I wanted ice cream. When I was like, well, I like ice cream, mom. When I was pregnant with your brother, I really want, and like, I, and I don't, I don't know whatever the cravings were. It depends. I mean, 'cause, it giving birth to a child, I can't, I couldn't do it. I mean, first of all, you have this parasitic alien inside
Oh,
you. It's sucking you dry. It wants stuff all the time. And, it's messing up with your entire individual ecosystem. It's like, what the hell's going on? And it's the one thing, like with her, every time I watch the movie and I look at, poor Rosemary, I just keep thinking, this thing is like digesting her from within.
Oh,
It's
yeah.
just, it's just, oh, it's just awful. And so what do you think about that?
You know what? I really think it's weird because I think the film does a good job of conveying a certain reality. And maybe that's because it's not sort of hamstrung by trying to be like a William Castle film, perhaps, or a Herschel Gordon Lewis film, kind of.
Oh my God.
No, I mean,
Can
not
you
to say.
imagine?
Yeah, I know, but it's like it wasn't that type of movie, and
No.
maybe if someone else had made it, they would have gone for a certain, oh, well, people aren't going to sit and watch this because it's more moody than there's mood, but there's not enough violence or there's not enough overt horror. And I think that I guess the Robert Evans gamble was trusting Polanski to sort of deliver something that's like an extremely slow burn, but it's very rewarding as it goes along. And I think to that end, they do a really good job of presenting sort of the realities of conflict between couples. Even before you get to like the punchline at the end, it's like the stuff you see Guy and Rosemary going through is very indicative. I've been in relationships and I've had exchanges with my girlfriend where we're getting into a heated argument about something, and then oh, something ha then something happens that totally diffuses it, and we're laughing, so there is, I think there was a certain perceptiveness, to those exchanges. I think there was a certain perceptiveness to Rosemary. I found myself really taken with you know, the botched meeting with Hutch outside the Time Life building.
Oh, yeah.
Where she seems to be kind of, she looks terrible.
Oh my God, yeah. Looks like she's going to die any second.
Pretty much, she's pretty much porcelain white from that point onward in the movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's even talking to herself, but she's laughing while she's talking to herself. She's like, oh, am I really, you know... It's like as if she's saying, oh, is this really all just in my head?
What is this?
You know, you're left to kind of guess, is this like what's causing her to feel that way? What's causing her to react mm-hmm. in that way? But it's not, you don't have someone walking up to her and saying, oh, hey, you PMSing baby or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. some misogynistic screenwriter, you know, males writing chick flicks bullshit. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know. So,
oh man,
but something I like, Bill, and we didn't mention yet, Christoph Komeda's wonderful score to the film.
Yes,
I love the the contrast between when the score is upbeat versus when the score is very ominous and menacing, because
yeah,
that scene outside the Time Life building and everybody's shopping. Oh, and Minnie just happens to show up. She's doing some shopping too. It's fantastic because the music is so cheerful and so upbeat, but it's contrast to everything we're seeing.
Yeah.
And what Rosemary is obviously. Exactly. And I kind of love that. It's very jarring, but mm-hmm. I think it's kind of it's a bit of contrast and irony that pays off pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, because, and it does, throughout, because, you know, we're looking at a woman who, she's been lied to, she's been manipulated, she's been physically, emotionally, and sexually abused, and for her to even stand up at the end of this movie at all, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, and why was she standing up? Because she's a mother, I have a child, I'm going to protect it. And anybody gets in my way, they're going to get a knife in the belly. And that's pretty much what it came down to. And yeah. It was like, man, you know, power. And then, but the music just, like you said, it just does go so well with it. It helps paint that atmosphere. And like you were talking about, the elements of realism throughout that really make this a potent horror movie, because you think it's so real, because it's a drama first.
Mm-hmm.
And a good one and an intense one. And when you have that, you know, horror laid down, oh man, it works stronger than any crappy slasher film you've seen could ever do. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's why 50 years on, and I mean 50 years from now, if we're still around, you know,
mm-hmm.
people will continue to talk about this film as as a model of, you know, this. You know, you want to make a horror movie that doesn't have a lot of violence, is heavily character driven, yet keeps things, you know, just out of arm's reach. This is what you should watch. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really a powerful film, very potent. And it holds up in regard, you know, maybe not in the fashion and everything else, you know, Vidal Sassoon and his haircut and all, but, you're like, look at that radical stuff you do with your hair. And, oh, that bastard. And, but it resonates in so many ways about, you know, so many issues that women are still, you know, having to deal with, which is awful. But I think that's another reason why it resonates, is because of that, you know, the whole, who controls the pregnancy, you know what I mean?
Well, Bill, you know, there's something you were alluding to Dr. Saperstein just a bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something about him and something about the cast of it is kind of like, you know what, by getting what we want, we're kind of preserving this like old guard, this old vanguard in a way, mm-hmm. this old boys and girls club of Satanists kind mm-hmm. of.
Ancient Roman. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And the fall of Rome. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a pretty
mm-hmm.
interesting observation, though. It's like they're inducting the younger group in there. But what's going to be the function of the younger people?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering, too, because, you know, once, you know, like, I don't know what you're going to. I don't know. I really don't. But yeah, because I was thinking, well, what's the purpose after a while? It's like, well, we don't need you anymore. We're the old witches. Your kids are going out. You know, I don't. Hit the bricks.
Hit the bricks, kid, because you are going out.
You call yourself a Satanist, you son of a bitch? Put that coffee down. No. Oh, and when we say Satanist, comparing them to LaVey Satanists or anything like that. That's a completely different animal. It's no disrespect to those people at all. It's to this particular group of bad witches who didn't lure Guy to the dark side with cookies, but with a vodka blush and a promise of a shitty little acting role. Can you imagine? Can you, like, what would you have to do to go, yeah, you know what? Yeah, have Satan come up and rape my wife. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, you're like, what the hell's wrong with you?
And you got to stand and watch. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to stand and watch. And he was, like, not really affected by it.
Well, yeah, the only thing he does is it's sort of garbled under the chanting, but he's like something, is he like saying, oh, can she see us? Is she awake?
Yeah. He's more concerned about him.
Yeah.
Oh, that son of a bitch. Oh, man, he should be hacked up with a machete in that movie, man. Jesus Christmas. What an asshole.
He probably met with an unfortunate boating accident after the film, Bill.
Something floating in the East River. Bastard.
Yeah, it's like the opening of Cruising. That arm belonged to Guy Woodhouse. Yeah.
Oh my god. Oh man. But yeah, that was just, what a son of a bitch, you know. And the whole old world thing, yeah, the generation elements. I mean, there's so much to explore in this. I think as you know you're an excellent film critic, Johnny, and I think if you wanted to, you could write a book on this whole movie.
At the very least, Bill, I'll probably write a supplementary article for Crash Palace, because I had about 5 pages worth of notes just from watching the film last. So yeah,
man, because I was going to work on a book for The Thing, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing, but it's like, that's gonna, I did the same thing you did, and I took notes, I watched frame by frame, and I'm pausing it, and I'm like, I never saw that before, holy shit. Oh my god, I got an idea, I can't believe this happened. Oh man. You know, and I saw the movie like 50 times. But yeah, this is a one loaded film. If you love quality horror, this is, you have to see it.
Yeah, and definitely Mia Farrow gives a fantastic performance. And you know what? It's right there in the title. Rosemary, that's her. She dominates the film, even though you don't think she, you know, as given the plot synopsis, you don't think she would, but like I said, watching it this last time, she's extremely assertive. She's no dummy.
No.
She takes action. And something I like, Bill, just as I love the little ruse she does at the end when Guy and Saperstein are walking her back up to her fateful meeting with the cast of vets. Mm-hmm. She deliberately dumps her purse, and what do? They immediately get down and start putting the stuff back in her purse, giving her time to run away. Such a chivalrous bunch, don't you think?
I know. I know. Oh, and how she's hiding the pills later on, and oh, it's awesome. And Guy, weren't you a little rough on me last night? I think there's like gouges in my flesh on my back. Oh, no, we had a good time, honey. You're like, what a fucking, oh my god! I still, after all these years, I think I want to go back in time and just, like you said, you want to just kill him. You know, you want to kill Saperstein. Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, that freaking Nazi doctor type, holy crap.
Oh, well, the thing is, like, oh, you don't need to read any books, Rosemary. Just drink the drink, and those books will just put ideas in your head. And even Guy throws out the book she's reading on pregnancy, and he's, oh my god, he's such an asshole.
Yeah. Oh, he is so controlling, and trying to be controlling, and you know, and again, man, you know, patient advocacy. It's like, be your own advocate. This is the movie to watch. It's like,
oh god.
Well, my body's craving pepperoni while I'm with child, so I want to eat pepperoni. Well, you should. I'm eating it. You know, it's like, you know, okay. You know, I have no idea where that came from, but you know.
Physician, heal thyself through Satan. But yeah, it's a wonderful movie. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. How many stars did you give it, Johnny?
You know what? I actually bumped it up from the last time I watched it. It's a 4.5 out of 5 for me.
Oh, it's a 5 for me, man.
It was, you know, Bill, it was really close. I was like, man, could this be my first perfect movie? But maybe next time it'll be 5.
Well, two cool things to consider in that lullaby in the beginning. Apparently she's singing the lullaby, Mia Farrow. And one of my another cool scene, because I was wondering how they did it so well, is when she's crossing the street through traffic.
Yes.
And Roman Polanski was behind her with a camera, and this wasn't staged. Like, people weren't prepared. He was like, just go, just start walking, the cars will stop. And he was like, okay, she did it. And it was like, that was real, man. That was real.
And that was totally surreal, too, to watch.
Yeah, because, yeah. Like, you know, she's acting, and, you know, inside she's like, I'm going to get killed by a Chevy. Oh, my
but
God.
But she's so worn down, she doesn't even notice the cars coming on her.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Must watch horror, man, for real.
Absolutely.
50 years. Wow.
It's incredible. Here's to... This is year one, Bill, actually, so yeah.
Ah! Oh, man. So, wow.
I think Bill, do you want to scream out to the ones that have the funny eyes?
Yeah, and Johnny and I agreed that this month, because of, you know, Women in Horror Month, we are screaming out to women. So, guys, don't feel rejected or dejected. We'll get back to you at another time. But here we go. The first one. Real Jilly G.
Yep.
Our wonderful friend from the Toronto area. You could find her on CrimsonQuintessence.com. She is a wonderful woman, writer, poet. She's into The Walking Dead, supports indie film, horror, art, music, photography, the women's movement. She's an advocate, a survivor, a Scorpio as well. She's just really fantastic human being. Another one. I mean, they're all fantastic. They're all beautiful. They're all amazing. They're all intelligent. So here we go. That continues. Tracy_TR.
Yep.
She is the owner, the woman behind Scream Radio, and that is SCRM. Keep the E out for eerie. I have no idea. I just made that up. She's in the, I mean, how cool does this get? Wine, reading. I mean, come on. You know, she's into the Fright family. And go to her website as well, Tracy, and that's with CEE.co. The Fabulous, you know her, you love her, you can't be Tank without her. Nicole M. Alonzo. And Nikki Alonzo, she's right now down in Halloween Town, USA. You could follow her at NicoleAlonzo.com. And she is, of course, the woman who plays Tank in the Crawl or Die film, written and directed by Oklahoma Ward. And the sequel is coming. So check out Crawl or Die. Go to crawlordietrilogy.com, please. Melanie McCurdy.
Yep.
Wonderful person. She said, this is what I do. I slay things. She's an author, an artist, a poet. She supports indie, everything, I guess. And she's available worldwide through Amazon. And also go to her website, melaniemccurdy.com. The Fabulous, just getting over the flu as we record this. Kim McDonald, she is Dixie Fairy. She's a little horror junkie from Charleston. And you could find her stories and reviews at fairymusings.wordpress.com. And, of course, the amazing loudgreenbird.com and mydailydead.com. And she also did one article for crashpalace.com, crashpalaceproductions.com. Letitia Figueroa, what a writer. You could find her at Latash Figueroa. She's an author with a bent towards the dark side, absolutely. She's a yogi wannabe music lover. She's unafraid of heights. And you could follow her at Letitia Figueroa-author.com, also at Amazon.com, and she's on Instagram at Frayed, F-A-R-A-Y-E-D pages. She's an amazing writer. She wrote one of the books that she wrote was in From the Perception of a Male, and she nailed it, man. Absolutely fantastic. Nice. Susan Layton, Susan on the Ledge. writer girl, tequila expert. I love her. That's all you need, a bon vivant. You could check her stuff out at also 1428_Elm. That's my E. Also cult_faction, VHS Revival, and go to thequeenofstyle.com. And of course, she's spearheading the whole bring back boomstick.com movement for Ash versus Evil Dead. In fact, she even announced it on Twitter that she's interviewing the cast. I am so thrilled for her and so fucking jealous at the same time. Yeah. And also check out her amazing blog spot because she is one hell of a writer. I'm off the ledge.blogspot.com. Carolyn Sames, and that's actually Sames Carolyn, writer, producer of indie films, president at Universal Staffing. She's creating a sitcom, a traveler, and she's rated number one on Twitter in Las Vegas. And she supports indie film. Check her out. And the awesome Doug's mom. Who is that? That's Blank Petra. P-E-T-R-A. And what is she into? Horror and zombies. The Walking Dead. American Horror Story. Game of Thrones. Vikings. Blood and Gore. Extreme horror books and films. She belongs to Shiraz Nights. And she is a part of the Fright family as well. Horror family and TWD family. And she's out of Germany. Tamara Ferguson, otherwise known as Tammy's Dragonfly, award-winning author, Tales of the Dragonfly, their bestsellers, Two Hearts Surrendered, also a number one, and A Touch of Passion. Mm. And one of the things that I love about Tammy is she is so generous as an author. She helps promote authors left and right, like her brothers and sisters. So she's a sweetheart. Also, check out her site at kissedbyfate.com. So, Johnny, those are the scream outs.
Well, Billy, where can people find you?
At CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show and also to wonderful articles, including those from the great Johnny Numb and Dixie Fairy herself, Kim McDonald. You could also follow me on Twitter at Crash Palace. I'm trying to remember. I'm getting confused. Like, what do I got now? Instagram at Billy Crash. And that's pretty much it. But what do you got, Johnny?
In addition to CrashPalaceProductions.com, you can find my writing on film at LoudGreenBird.com.
Yes.
And you can also find me. What am I doing? You can also find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Numb. There are no H's in those Johnnies. The H would be for hell, ooh, fire, if I did have an H in my name. So.
Wow, man.
It's heavy, Bill.
Yeah, it is. And so remember, everybody, take your Tannis root.
Billy, why don't you finish your chocolate mouse and we can get out of here already, okay?
Take your Tannis root and don't call me in the morning because we'll already be there. Sorry.
Take two Tannis roots and call me in the morning, Rosemary.
Sounds like a porn film. On that note, have a great one, Johnny.
You too, Bill. See you later.
Oh, boy. Bye.